From the studios at Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. On Monday, what appears to be a draft opinion on abortion by the U.S. Supreme Court was leaked by Politico. Now, that leak pointed to the court overturning Roe versus Wade, which would put an end to constitutional protections for abortion and give control back to individual states. In a piece yesterday in the Washington Post, two individuals looked at Idaho's history with abortion laws and how that history might inform the future. Joining us now are the authors of that column titled Republicans Could Rue the Supreme Court Ending Abortion Rights, Mark Johnson, a historian and columnist, and Robert Saldine, a political scientist at the University of Montana and senior fellow with the Niskanen Think Tank in Washington, D.C. I want to welcome both of you to the program.
Thanks, Gemma.
With you.
With you.
Back in 1990, Democrat Cecil Andrus was governor of Idaho, and the state legislature was dominated by Republicans. Mark, can you take us back in time? What was the political mood like at that point?
Well, it was. It's a different time. I mean, that's 30 plus years ago, Gemma. But the political dynamics in terms of the partisanship in the state were not unlike they are right now. Democrats maybe had a few more seats in the state legislature than they do today. And a Democratic governor, Andrus, was in his third non-consecutive term as governor. And 1990 being an election year, there was no doubt that he was going to seek a fourth term as governor, which he ultimately did. There was a spirited race in the Republican Party for a candidate to take on the governor, who I was working for at that time as press secretary. Mm-hmm. So it was an election year. All of the statewide constitutional officers were on the ballot. The entire legislature was up for election in November. And abortion came to really define the 1990 session of the legislature.
And at that point, then, the Idaho legislature passed an abortion bill. Can one of you speak on what was in it?
Well, sure. It became known in shorthand as House Bill 625, originated in the House of Representatives. It was clearly designed, and the sponsors were not at all reticent to talk about how it had come about. It was essentially drafted by national anti-abortion groups with the express intent of getting a piece of legislation that could make its way back before the U.S. Supreme Court. Mm. The idea was that at the time, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, the only woman on the court at the time, was thought to be kind of a swing vote on abortion cases, and that this legislation that Idaho eventually passed was designed to perhaps influence her or appeal to her in a way that some other legislation had not. It was very restrictive. It did provide for exceptions in the case of rape or incest or the health of the mother, although the restrictions were drawn so tightly in the law as to make those exceptions basically unworkable or untenable. But as I said, it worked its way through the legislature, beginning in the House, passing fairly substantially about midway during the legislative session. There was some belief, as I recall at the time, that maybe the legislature would sort of blink on this and maybe not go forward and have it actually wind up on the governor's desk, but it eventually did.
Mm-hmm. And Gemma, maybe I'd just jump in to Mark nails it. And just to give a flavor of some of these restrictions, right? If for the rape exception to play in, the rape victim would have had to have reported the crime to police within 7 days. And in the case of the incest exception, that only applies if the victim was under 18 years old. So I think it's not a stretch to say that had this bill passed and been signed by the governor, it would have created the country's most restrictive abortion regime at that point.
Mm. And Robert, what was happening while the lawmakers were debating this bill? Because in the article, you write about candlelight vigils and news reporters camped out at the Capitol building. And, you know, here we are 30 years later, kind of seeing the same thing happen around the country.
Well, in a way, I think Mark could probably speak to that better than I. I was in sixth grade at Garfield Elementary.
Not down at the Capitol protesting.
No, I wasn't down at the Capitol. But one indication, Gemma, of how big a deal this was is that I have very, very clear memories of it, right? Still being in grade school. Right. You know, it's one of the things that I remember very, very clearly. People were talking about it, you know, not necessarily out on the playground, but boy, my parents and all the adults in my life were very clearly aware of this. And you had, you know, among other things, reporters from all over the country, international press camped out outside Cecil Andrus's office there in the Capitol. You had Robert Novak, the famous conservative columnist, writing about it. In fact, in one of his columns, he said that Mother Teresa, of all people, had called Governor Andrus, but that Andrus had refused to take her call. Now that turned out to be a hoax, but that gives you a little bit of a flavor of what a circus-like environment this was. Yeah.
Well, and
I could
Mark,
maybe
how
just
much-
add a little more color quickly, Gemma. You know, the State House, the governor's office on the second floor in the west wing of the Capitol. This was before the Capitol was renovated. So there really was very little space for all of these out of town and even international journalists who showed up to cover this story. So literally, I came to work the morning that the bill was presented to the governor, and all of these reporters are literally camped out in the hallway outside the governor's office, lining both sides of the hallway, television cameras everywhere. They had no other place to work in the building, so they were literally, you know, sitting on the floor outside the governor's office waiting for some sense of what was going to happen to this legislation. There were daily and nightly vigils on the Capitol steps to the point where people were asked to not burn candles because there was so much wax building up on the steps of the Capitol, if you can imagine such a thing. So it was Andrus described it as a circus-like atmosphere, and it very, very much was. Mm-hmm. One other just thing that really sticks in my mind about that period was these were pre-cell phone or internet days. So the quickest communication for a lot of people was to fax a letter to the governor. Our fax machine was literally running 24 hours a day for a month with just these massive piles of mail coming in on the fax machine. So it was really the most remarkable moment that I remember in 9 years of working for Cece Andrus.
Mm-hmm. And Mark, as you mentioned in the beginning of this interview, this bill wasn't just about abortion because it was in the midst of an election year. So very similar to what we have seen this year with Governor Little signing an abortion bill. It's an election year. So this puts a governor, I think, whether Democrat or Republican, in a really tough position. What did Governor Andrus face if he signed that bill? Or if he vetoed it?
Well, it's a really great question, and one that I think everybody that was paying attention to Idaho politics at the time was kind of running around in their mind. What is the political consequence? What is the fallout one way or the other as to how the governor deals with this legislation? He had, throughout his political career, taken a position that he was a pro-life Democrat. He basically subscribed to the policy position on abortion that, at the time at least, was the position of the LDS Church, the Mormon Church, which was that abortion was not acceptable except in these narrow cases of rape, incest, when the life of the mother is threatened through some difficulty with the pregnancy. So that was his consistent position throughout his political career, which dated back to the 1960s. So very clearly, I think, part of the intent of at least some of the sponsors was to create some political difficulty for the governor in his reelection, particularly when you consider that the three Republican candidates who were running.
Oh, did we just lose Mark? I think we just lost Mark. All right. So Mark, apologies to our listeners. We got cut off there for a moment. So as we were saying, this was an election year. This abortion bill comes to Governor Andrus's desk. There are major implications for him signing this or not signing this.
Indeed. As I was saying before we got interrupted there, I think part of the motivation, at least by some of the sponsors of the legislation, was to put the governor in a box. Most Democrats in Idaho then, as now, were not in favor of this legislation. So they wanted to, drive a wedge between the governor and his most ardent supporters, for sure, and to kind of redefine the election as a referendum on abortion. Andrus, just to refresh your memory, had a couple of years earlier closed Idaho's borders to nuclear waste imports from the United States government. And that was a very big political moment. And I think some of the impetus behind, again, at least some of the sponsors of the anti-abortion legislation was to take some of the wind out of the governor's sails. So clearly it had some political implications.
So, Mark, did the governor sign the abortion ban?
You know, the bill, as I recall, Gemma, arrived on a Monday, the last week in March, as the legislature was racing toward adjournment. He spent all of that week assessing the legislation and reaching out to a variety of experts, including legal scholars at places like Brigham Young University and the University of Idaho. And on Friday, late Friday afternoon of that week, March 30, 1990, he walked across the street from the Capitol building to the Joe R. Williams building in the big conference room there, which was packed with reporters, and announced that he would veto House Bill 625.
When he vetoed that bill, the Governor Andrus said that Idaho is not a patsy. Mark, can you give us the exact quote and tell us what he meant by that?
That actually came at close to the end of his remarks. He read a prepared statement outlining his concerns about the legislation, same kind of things that Rob was alluding to earlier about how completely restrictive it was, so as to make the exceptions basically unworkable and, as Andrus said, lacking in any sense of compassion to the victims of crimes of rape and incest. And then he opened it up for questions from reporters to ask him about, his reasoning and rationale and the political implications. And he, I distinctly remember, he said, "Well, I have no idea what the political implications are. My job is not to assess legislation based upon it, the politics involved, but to do what is best for the state of Idaho." And part of his rationale for vetoing the legislation was this idea that it was a national gambit on the part of the anti-abortion forces to use Idaho as a way to get a piece of legislation back before the Supreme Court. And Andrus rejected that out of hand. And that's when he said, some people have made the assumption that Idaho is a patsy, meaning a foil, somebody that you could push around. And he said, "I'm here to tell you, Idaho is no patsy."
I mean, in fact, Mark, he was reelected for a fourth term by a wide margin, and the rest of the Democratic Party did pretty well in those elections that year.
Well, there were always many factors that play into an election outcome, but clearly the abortion bill played large in 1990. Rob and I made the case in our piece in the Washington Post that it what really was the modern high water mark for Democrats in Idaho. Three of the five statewide constitutional officers went to Democrats that year. Democrats won enough seats in the state Senate to share power with Republicans. So it was a really, and Andrus won with nearly 70% of the vote against a candidate who had tried to make the abortion issue a centerpiece of his campaign.
Mm-hmm. Rob, in that Washington Post article that, you and Mark wrote this week, you write saying that what happened in Idaho in 1990 is a good proxy for what could happen if the Supreme Court draft opinion is correct. What do you see happening?
Yeah, well, Gemma, I think one key thing to understand and that we touch on in the piece is that abortion has worked really well for the Republican Party ever since Roe. And part of that has to do with just the obvious observation that for a lot of people, abortion is a moral cause. They feel deeply that that it's immoral. But another piece of it, and a key piece of it, I think, is that part of the reason abortion has been so powerful on the right is that it is wrapped up with with a sense of unfairness, and that they got cheated in that it was taken out of the democratic process, the normal public policy process that had been playing out state by state, and sent to the court because pro-choicers felt like they couldn't win through the normal public policy process. So they took it to the court, and then at the hands of these unelected and unaccountable judges clinging to this made-up notion of a right to privacy, they announced a nationwide right to an abortion. Right now, we could take issue with any number of aspects of that perspective, but the point is that a key to abortion politics has been this sense of grievance on the right that that they screwed on this. And so what Mark and I say in the piece is that that thing that has galvanized the American right for so long could very easily flip, and because now we're assuming this opinion holds up, and that that's the final word of the court, you're going to have a right taken away that has been a part of the American fabric for nearly 50 years. People have come to rely on it. They take it for granted. And that's going to cause an understandable sense of grievance out there among people who were uneasy with having that right taken away.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit more about that, Rob, because in, the article, I mean, you write that overturning constitutional protections for abortion could really backfire on Republicans. And you mentioned this about it being on this right that we don't think about. I mean, my lifetime, abortion has been legal. Roe v. Wade has stood. I literally cannot wrap my brain around the fact that that may not be the case. And then I look at the generations behind me, and it is mind-boggling.
Right. And of course, it's going to play out state by state now. Overturning Roe doesn't mean abortion is all of a sudden not allowed. It's going to be thrown back to the states. And so it'll be a decision left to each state. Some places it'll be legal and kind of status quo as it's been for the last 50 years. Other places, it could be entirely illegal. And so, I think that really changes the dynamic here. You know, abortion has worked so well, but it's always been on for Republicans and conservatives. It's always been kind of just slightly out of reach. But now it's right there. And so that really does change the dynamic, right? You have considering the real world impact of taking away a right, and I think that's what happened in the Idaho case back in 1990. People were forced to really grapple with this, not in some kind of abstract culture war way, but in like, gosh, this could really happen. You know, what do we think about this as a reality on the ground. And the politics on that, it's not at all clear to me that that still works to the benefit of Republicans. And I think we actually get a little bit of a tell on that in looking at how Republicans are responding to this. For the most part, they are not talking about the substance of the leaked opinion. They're talking about the leak itself. And that suggests to me that they're perhaps a little bit uneasy and don't know quite how to respond to this situation.
Well, and their argument has been this right to privacy for the Supreme Court. Like, this is unprecedented. I mean, they have this right to privacy to make these opinions in private. And yet, you know, the opinion is to take away the right of privacy. And before I let you go, you know, with that point of Republicans, you know, being silent or just talking about the leak itself and not what the leak is saying, it's then on the flip side seems to be galvanizing Democrats. And Rob, just like 1990, it's an election year. And in some states, like Idaho, it's a contentious election year.
Yeah, and I think it has the potential, you know, not only to galvanize Democrats and perhaps increase turnout in the midterms in a year when everything else is pushing in the Republicans' direction and you have the normal midterm lag and everything. But I think this is also something that you could see play out in the suburbs and not just among Democratic voters, but among independents and even many Republicans. You know, it's not something that Republicans have really had to, like rank and file Republicans have really had to grapple with, because it never, it always seemed so far out as a possibility. And in fact, the stars did kind of need to align in any number of ways to get us to this point. But I think you could have a broad section of the country. I mean, we actually know this from opinion polls. As ambivalent as most Americans are about abortion, clearly overturning Roe v. Wade, that's not something that the people want. And that's not just limited to Democrats.
Right. Well, I appreciate the two of you coming on the program. We've been talking with Mark Johnson, columnist and historian, and Robert Saldin, a political scientist at the University of Montana. They wrote about Idaho's history with abortion yesterday in the Washington Post. We will, of course, link that on our website. Thank you both for this look back in history, but also taking us to today and how we can just see how the past and the present seem to be colliding. So thank you both.
Thank you, Gemma. Good to be with you, Rob.
Thanks, Gemma. Thanks, Mark.
Absolutely. Thank you. And up next, Mark is actually going to stay with us because we're going to look at this year's race for governor and how more of Idaho's history might foreshadow a winner. Thank you.